Welcome to Simoncast, the official podcast of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. I'm John Shaw, the director of the Institute. In Simoncast, we aim to keep the legacy of Paul Simon alive and well through wide-ranging civil conversations. And we're delighted today to be joined by Ben Smith, a terrific journalist and entrepreneur, and also the author of a really important and interesting book called Traffic. The subtitle is Genius, Rivalry, and Delusion, and the Billion-Dollar Race to Go Viral. Ben is also the co-founder of a really important new company called Semaphore, and we're going to talk about that and traffic primarily. Let me tell you a little bit about Ben. He grew up in New York City. He went to Yale University, had a terrific career in journalism. He's done about everything. He's actually started out in this part of the world working for the Indianapolis Star. Then he went to Europe working for the Baltic Times and the Wall Street Journal Europe, and then worked for several really important New York newspapers, New York Sun, New York Observer, New York Daily News, was a reporter at Politico for a number of years. And then for about a decade was editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed News, and left that to become the media correspondent for the New York Times, and then left that to be the co-founder of Semaphore. So doing really important work, and Ben is joining us from his office in New York City. So good afternoon, Ben.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
Great. Well, Ben, as I was reading about your background, I was thinking, you know, one of the kind of job requirements for a journalist is to kind of, you know, sift through conflicting narratives and complicated information and try to kind of ascertain what the truth is. And I smiled as I read about your background because I think your dad is a kind of a conservative Republican, your mom a liberal Democrat. At the dinner table, were there a lot of sort of conflicting narratives and arguments? I mean, was political discussion part of how you grew up?
Yeah, I think actually maybe it's not that unusual for journalists, political journalists, to grow up in environments where, you know, people they care about have very deep differences about politics. And it kind of leaves you sort of relatively open to the notion that people who disagree with each other can be in good faith.
Great. And I was also intrigued in reading about your background. Your one of your grandfathers was a writer and actually was a ghostwriter for Mickey Mantle's memoir. And I think also Tommy John. Is that right?
Yeah, there was a copy of Mickey Mantle's memoir, like a galley lying around when I was a kid. And in the way of ballplayers, ghostwriters, like, I don't think he'd read the thing at all. It just said, looks good, Mickey. Like, that was the only note.
And your grandmother was
fictionalization.
Pardon me?
I think there was some heavy fictionalization.
Okay. And then your grandmother, as I understand it, was a Mark Twain expert. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Did you have any family trips to Hannibal or anything like that? Or I mean, would she talk about Twain?
No, I didn't really know her, but we definitely read a lot of Mark Twain and heard a lot of Mark Twain growing up, for sure. Okay.
Well, let's talk about you went to Yale and you studied linguistics there. And I that struck me as kind of an esoteric discipline. How did you decide to study linguistics?
Oh, I mean, honestly, it was a terrible mistake. Like, I wanted to be a journalist, and I always tell people not to study linguistics now because I kind of thought it would ladder up to language and journalism and things like that, and never did. It was always basically math, and felt totally useless. Although, funny story, now all the people I went to school with are running AI and machine translation companies, because did turn out that like language models were a thing, but not my thing.
Okay, great. But I think that maybe the more important part of your Yale experience, I think it was your junior year, you did an internship with The Forward, which is a New York City newspaper, very important, influential. Talk about that experience and how that shaped your interest in journalism.
Yeah, that's really what got me into it. I had a gig at the Jewish Forward, which was a once great, really like once incredibly powerful newspaper with like 300,000 or 400,000 subscribers and a tower in Lower Manhattan in Yiddish. That had, you know, Yiddish had gone a little out of fashion and they'd revived it as an English edition. And I mean, I remember at some point asking like who reads this, and the answer was, well, it's two Jews, but it's the right two Jews, and that was kind of the idea. But it was run by this brilliant editor who'd been the foreign editor of the Wall Street Journal named Seth Lipsky. And, you know, I just got kind of hooked on political reporting, really covered state Senate races, sort of understand, just, you know, it's a very strange business, as you know, covering politics. Partly because, you know, the media is very intertwined in it. I found it kind of endlessly fascinating, and went on to, yeah, kind of look for jobs like that.
Well, I want to jump into political journalism in just a second, but I noticed in your bio that your first job, I think, out of college was with the Indianapolis Star and kind of the city government or crime beat. Is that right?
Yeah.
We had Carl Hulse from the New York Times here on campus a couple months ago, and he was regaling us with stories. He's from Illinois and began working for newspapers, small town newspapers in Illinois. And he was saying it was one of the hardest jobs he had in journalism in terms of being just, you know, sort of face to face with the people that you're writing about, you know, just sort of the importance of just having it right, because those kind of details, you know, matter to people in their lives. I mean, talk about your time at the Indianapolis Star.
I
mean,
I was only there for like less than half a year. It was a post-college fellowship. But I totally agree with Carl. Like, there's something, you know, when you cover politics, half the time, if you make a mistake, the people involved won't even bother correcting you because they don't really care. They just kind of care about the gist of the thing. Whereas, as you say, like, you know, you're writing about somebody, you know, who's lost a loved one, or somebody who's being thrown in jail. The details really, really matter. And the people, it's, you're face to face with people for whom these stories are incredibly important, and sort of the, you know, meeting people on the worst days of their lives. And it does teach you a kind of discipline in the reporting that I think that people who come up sort of covering hazier national stuff, like, never really learn the kind of, or it's harder to learn just that, like, you have to sort of ground it in this underlying reality.
Well, let's talk about political reporting, because that you did it during your time in Europe, but especially when you, as I understand your career in New York, you were, I think, covering City Hall for a number of newspapers. And in your book, you talk about being fixated with political journalism and the rush of breaking news. Talk about that kind of initial experience in covering New York city politics, and it may have extended to state as well. But talk about that initial experience in terms of wedding your interest and passion for political journalism.
I mean, you know, for me, actually, like, I mean, I always liked it in a fairly conventional way, but it was really, I mean, this sort of segues into the book, I guess, but the sort of rise of, you know, I sort of happened to be covering New York City Hall at the moment when these, you know, when I, in 2000, and I guess 2004, reading all these blogs about national politics and thinking like, huh, wouldn't it be cool if there was something in local politics like this, in terms of just like the, how live the conversation was, how directly you're talking to people. I mean, it really was this moment where if you didn't, you know, control a printing press or a broadcast tower, you really had no way of communicating with lots of people. And the internet, it was just in the early stages of blowing that up. And so, and particularly with politics, which in its way is the same, like, you know, you're talking to the right two Jews, sort of a beat. You're talking at first to your sources, and to a relatively small world of people who are intensely, intensely interested. And I remember thinking, you know, if I can get 100 people a day to read this thing, like, that'll be pretty successful. And it like blew my mind when I hit 1,000. There was this sort of immediacy to digital journalism that was very addicting, honestly. And like, for, you know, for better and for worse, I think a lot of the stuff that people who were on the internet in 2003, 2004, 2005, and 2006 felt, you know, just the sort of, like, it's just you're talking so directly to people, and you kind of know, and they talk right back to you, and you're sort of face to face with your readers in a way that with television or with print was sort of mediated. You know, it's really compelling. Like, what you want to do is tell people stories, like, you're just doing it the most direct imaginable way. And so I that sort of really got me hooked.
Well, let's talk about you know, the experience that is sort of the essence of your book. And I guess it's 2011, and you are being you're having a conversation with a gentleman by the name of Jonah Peretti about possibly joining BuzzFeed News. And I want to read a couple sentences from your book and then have you extrapolate. You're talking, and this was your preliminary meeting with him. And you say, at that point, I suppose sitting across from me was a little like sitting across the table from Twitter. I was 34 and I'd been blogging about politics since 2004 when it felt groundbreaking. My brain had been pretty well rewired.
I spent my distracted days only half listening to people I was talking to or the politicians I was covering. What was happening on Twitter often felt more real than the person in front of me. But in moments of lucidity between bites, this is your lunch, I told Jonah about politics, about the rush I've always gotten from breaking news, and how I'd seen Twitter replace individual blogs like mine as a place people follow news throughout the day. So, I mean, tell us about that conversation. And then also, as I understand it, your initial inclination was to decline. I think maybe you went back and talked to your wife who urged you to reassess. And so talk about the decision to make the plunge and to take the position at BuzzFeed News.
Yeah, I mean, so it really was that, you know, the blogs, and it's funny, like blogs, which felt like this new technology back then, now feel like I'm talking about some lost world, but had felt really groundbreaking. And in some ways were sort of proto social media. They had a lot of the same qualities of social media, were sort of talking to each other, but it was kind of slow and clunky. And by 2011, you could feel that the people reading your blog, your sources, the people you were writing about, other journalists you were competing with, they'd all moved to Twitter. And so when I sort of first ran across BuzzFeed, I was like, I'm not going to go work for a cat website, which is, you know, superficially what it was. But when you sort of step back from it, what they were really thinking about was a world which then seemed quite foreign, where instead of going to nytimes.com or buzzfeed.com or some website, you would sit down at your desktop computer then mostly and type in facebook.com or twitter.com, and stories would come to you through those platforms. And I was already sort of thinking like, yeah, like that's the world I live in. I'm trying to get my blog items to travel on Twitter. And what BuzzFeed had been doing was not merely selecting the world's cutest cats, but really thinking about what will people share on Facebook and on these other new platforms, which in that moment were silly memes and animal pictures, but were increasingly news. And he was thinking, okay, we should get into that business.
And let's talk about that that business in that era, because your book chronicles broadly about a 20-year period, but most intensely about a decade, and roughly from the time that you were, head of BuzzFeed News, 2011, to when you left about a decade later. And so as you were stepping into that position as the director of news, you know, what were your expectations? What were your hopes? What were you concerned about? Who did you see as competitors? I mean, what was your mind frame as you walked into this position?
I think it was a moment when the legacy media felt like totally disoriented and kind of under assault. You know, the shift to digital, which is where consumers were, hadn't come with any revenue. And so television companies, newspaper companies were just reeling and were sort of intimidated by these new technologies. And so in that moment, it sort of seemed plausible that like, yes, the future is this like weird cat website. And they were like, oh no, do we have to start writing about cats now? Like it was this moment when they were very incredibly weak, basically. And also I think the people sort of underestimate the extent to which the Iraq war had really discredited these outlets, and lots of people, you know, just had this kind of deep and pretty well-earned distrust for the New York Times, for NBC News. And between those things, I think there was just a lot of openness to this kind of weird new social world.
And talk, if you would, Ben, about just, so you're in this world with Gawker and Huffington Post and BuzzFeed, which you're leading, and Vox and others, but you also write about just the power of both Facebook and Twitter. I think at one point you refer to them as kind of waterfalls. Talk about just the importance of these two platforms for the digital news upstarts like yourself to thrive and grow.
I think, again, it comes down to sort of what people wanted in that moment. You sort of have to put your head back there. But there was a period when people thought, wow, this Facebook news feed with the sort of mix of silly stuff and serious stuff, the Twitter, the sort of wide open quality of Twitter, that these are just like incredibly cool, charming, fun, positive spaces where I'm having this new kind of very open conversation with a bunch of, you know, well-intentioned, interested strangers. That is obviously no longer how it feels. But I think and BuzzFeed was really trying to mirror that back to say, like, we're the sort of content provider for that strange new world.
Well, let's talk about, to kind of really get our arms around your book. I mean, there's two kind of words that jump out. First of all, traffic, of course, the title. But the other one that struck me was delusion, which is in your subtitle. Now, traffic is it was sort of the fuel by which entities measured themselves, or the metric that by which they measured themselves. Talk about how traffic became almost the kind of, you know, this dominant metric for the digital news space.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was this, I mean, it was, you know, it's as though we had sort of all been flying without instruments. And then suddenly, and not that news organizations had not wanted to build audiences and hadn't been trying to count their audiences and hadn't been trying to make money and hadn't been doing stupid, trashy stories to make money, right? Like, it's, you can over romanticize the past, but it was suddenly this sensation of being able to turn the lights on and see, like, okay, zero people are reading this story about the city council and a million people are reading this story about Kim Kardashian, where I thought maybe it was like three times as many people were reading that story. It's 1,000 times as many. And it was sort of disorienting, but it also provided these big opportunities to people who could kind of understand how to chase that traffic. And in the book, I kind of centered on two of the people who I think who were first to see that this digital media wasn't just an interesting toy and these weren't just kind of like clever little tools, but this was something that would swallow ultimately the whole media. But they also were, and they were obsessed with traffic, but they had very different ideas about what it would be. I think everybody was wrong in various ways. But I mean, so it was really interesting to go back into that era and see, okay, like Nick Denton, who started Gawker, really saw traffic and saw this digital explosion as a way to expose the hypocrisies of the old media. To say, like, you say you want to read this high-minded stuff about government, but really you just want to read porn, and so we're going to publish porn, like, literally. And that's in some ways exposing the hypocrisy of the reader. But also to say, you know what, like, we're going to publish the things that reporters talk to each other about in bars. We're not, and not the things that they put on the page, which, you know, at times meant being more honest in a salutary way too. But it was a fundamentally kind of negative and kind of dark impulse, I would say. And then Jonah Peretti had this idea about social media in particular, that because it was so public, that because, you know, like, information was going to spread when you shared it, that people would be fundamentally, and it's interesting how wrong this was, sharing positive things, that basically most of social media would almost of necessity be positive, because I'll share something about how you can help the victims of a earthquake because I want you to see me as a good person, basically. But I would never share some insane ranty political thing, because then you'll think I'm a psycho. That did not actually turn out.
And so, yeah, I mean, but let's talk about the delusion piece too, because as the book chronicles, I mean, the focus on traffic became extremely intense. And it seemed that at times, you know, traffic became an end unto itself. And even for people who are running news organizations, you know, it wasn't always clear that traffic then equated to revenues or to profits. So talk about what you meant, particularly in that subtitle, about the word delusion.
I think in this particular moment, it's very easy to say, wow, this stuff didn't work out. Like, the sort of central protagonists of this early internet moment, Vice and BuzzFeed, probably the biggest brands, Gawker, you know, a dozen others. A lot of them are out of business. A lot of them are kind of much reduced. And these were companies that were reaching like hundreds of millions of people every month or more for this period in the 2010s. And I do think, you know, the question is sort of like, what happened? And there were big cultural trends that I think kind of swamped them. This new right-wing populism that made the internet a much less sort of like safe and fun place. The decisions made by the platforms to basically monopolize the revenue that was coming through. I mean, one of the big things that I don't know if this was a delusion or just turned out to be incorrect, but something that I've been asked a lot is just, what were investors thinking, putting hundreds of millions of dollars into these businesses? Because very sophisticated investors, you know, places like Disney and NBC, invested very heavily in these new companies. And it's interesting to go back, and what they thought was that the birth of this digital, these digital platforms, was like the birth of cable. And, you know, cable had been this huge media revolution in the 80s. And a lot of the people involved had been around at the birth of MTV. And what they found was these, you know, these guys, cable guys, laid wires in the ground. And then realized that to charge people to connect those wires, they need to have stuff on them, and that they'd have to pay a lot for it. And companies like ESPN, like MTV, like Comedy Central, you know, all the cable channels, CNN, you know, grew out of that essentially kind of like business alignment, where the people who owned the infrastructure realized they needed to share the money with the people who made the content. And we all thought, okay, that's how social media is going to go. Facebook, Twitter, Snap, Pinterest are going to wind up paying companies like BuzzFeed to make content for them. That did not happen. And that was the biggest, you know, that was sort of the big mistake, I think, that these investors and these companies made.
Well, Ben, one of my favorite chapters in your book is about Disney. And that was, a pivotal moment, because, you know, BuzzFeed was in conversations with Disney, and Disney was very serious about acquiring BuzzFeed. And you tell a wonderful story about being part of a team that went to Los Angeles to have talks. And you describe a visit to Bob Iger's office in Burbank, California. And I want to read a couple sentences and maybe have you reflect on it. You said, Iger met us at the top of the elevator in the softly lit executive floor. He was alone, relaxed, wearing a sweater, and acting like an uncle who was thrilled you made it in time for Thanksgiving dinner. And then you went on to say the event had the false informality of all contemporary business meetings. And then you talk really vividly about the way that Jonah and Iger kind of went back and forth, and, you know, were kind of sizing each other up and repeating talking points and so forth. Talk about that meeting. I mean, just the atmospherics are sort of fun, but also the consequences, because I think at that point, Disney was willing to spend like $450 million or so to purchase BuzzFeed. Is that right?
Yeah. More. So it wound up like $600 million. Yeah.
Well, talk about that meeting. I mean, was that, just as like a journalist and observer, was this like, man, this is just, you know, I can't believe I'm here in this context, or?
Yeah. I mean, it's a world I'd never really set foot in. I mean, I'm, as you say, a journalist and not someone who'd been in these kind of boardrooms. Although I think at the time, you know, it's just so hard to get your head back there. We were on top of the world, we're growing like crazy, and felt like the future sort of belonged to us, and had almost a patronizing attitude toward these flailing old media types with their studio lots and their theme parks.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ben, one of, I think, the really compelling chapters too is your chapter on the New York Times. And I want to read a sentence or two and then have you talk about that. You said, as I write this book, the New York Times is the most successful news business in the world, one that has absorbed many of the stars of Gawker and BuzzFeed and their digital rivals. But at the end of the first decade of the 21st century, the Times was something of a laughingstock. And talk in particular about someone who I had never heard of until I read your book, David Perpich, who was a, I think we could say, kind of a visionary at the Times, who was able to sort of see where the future lay, and to really kind of engineer or lead a major shift at the Times. Talk about how the Times adapted, and, you know, led by Perpich, and how that had consequence for the whole kind of space.
Yeah, I mean, it was so interesting. I definitely didn't kind of come to writing a book about the internet thinking that the sort of winner would be the New York Times. But nor did I really like set out to write some sort of business school case study. But one of the really, really interesting things in writing about the Times was seeing how they had, they had sort of held on to their core identity as this great source of great journalism, right? Through as everybody else had been frantically chasing digital trends, and had survived to the point where people were barely survived, really, but that ultimately to the moment where people were willing to pay for subscriptions. Because the reason they couldn't sell subscriptions in 2000 wasn't because people didn't want to pay for them. It's just like you didn't have a phone you could pay for things on. Spotify didn't exist, Netflix didn't exist, or it wasn't selling digital subscriptions. The notion of paying money on the internet for media was new. And the Time sort of weathered that moment and then slowly and sort of painfully had to bring itself into this new digital era. And what was so interesting was the extent to which the people running it understood that, I mean, there's this old kind of like business school line that culture eats strategy for breakfast, but that in this family-owned business, like the family sort of had to lead it and people would follow their signals. So like A.G. Sulzberger led this very slightly pedantic report on how the internet was going to be a big thing. And everyone was then like, well, I guess like the new publisher is into this. And David Perpich, another cousin, was very crucial to moving this through. I mean, I remember when we were at sort of the peak of our arrogance at BuzzFeed and thinking about the Times, they had just launched a news app. And the guy running it was this great journalist who just won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of Russia, named Cliff Levy, who'd previously won another Pulitzer Prize in New York. And I remember Jonah Peretti, the founder of BuzzFeed, saying to me, man, you can't launch a news app at the New York Times unless you have won two Pulitzer Prizes. Like, you know. So, yeah.
So they were able to affect this transformation, which has put them in an extremely kind of solid place. So, Ben, I mean, what is in some of your writings, both in the book and then since, you've said, OK, that era is over and a new era is beginning. So what is the new era? Obviously we'll talk in just a second about your new company, which I presume is part of this new era, but where do you see this moment right now?
This is a really unusual, I mean, I guess I think the thing that's happening now is basically fragmentation. And I think there are a lot of, it's, you can't quite put your, I mean, I think in the last 10 years, if you said what's happening in media, the answer was social media, Facebook, Twitter, absorbing everything. Now, I think you see those platforms kind of unraveling and people going in audiences and journalists and creators going in all sorts of different directions. I mean, I think the most interesting stat I saw recently was that if you ask people, what's your favorite podcast? Like lots of people don't have a favorite podcast, but among the people who have a favorite podcast, the largest number, say in the US, say Joe Rogan is their favorite podcast, but the number who say that is just 5% of that smaller number. So it's a sort of space in which the largest entrant is sub 5% and everybody else is smaller. So it's a very, very fragmented universe where people are hearing in smaller quantities from voices they trust, not as much in these sort of huge central consolidated public squares.
Well, so as you left BuzzFeed in 2021, I think it was, you became the media columnist for the New York Times, wrote some terrific stories. I remember reading them. And I guess I sort of assumed that you were settling in for a time. And then, you know, news, broke that you were creating this new venture. It's something that I know you had been discussing with your co-founder, Justin Smith, no relation, for some time. Talk about what you're trying to do. How do you establish yourself in this fragmenting media environment?
It's very different from the social media moment when you're just trying to sort of reach as many people as possible and touch them lightly and hope that you can get them again tomorrow. I mean, here we're very focused on building kind of one-to-one connections with our audience. Hope folks will sign up for our newsletters at semaphore.com. And, and to do it in niches where we're talking to people who are very, very plugged in or very, very interested in those spaces. So that's politics, technology, finance, media.
Well, in your note on the website explaining the mission of Semaphore, you say, readers, listeners, and viewers are drowning in a stew of assertions and opinions. And you've asked people in polls and private conversations what they think of this media environment. They'll tell you they hate it. They're overwhelmed, disoriented, and don't know what to trust. So talk about what you're doing, particularly in the sense of trying to to combat this feeling of being overwhelmed, and also what you're doing, what sort of techniques you've embraced to give your newsletters and your articles a sense of kind of authenticity and something that people can trust.
I mean, I guess I would say, you know, two things, and the biggest one really is just the coming from a place of transparency. You should know, you know, the reporter who's, these stories are produced by humans still, and particularly beat reporters know a lot and have opinions about what the stuff they're writing about. I don't mean sort of partisan political opinions, I mean more analytical opinions that routinely, and I'm sure when you were a journalist, you sort of have to smuggle it into a story by way of picking and choosing adjectives and quotes. And I think, you know, we want you to know who you're hearing from, and like hire great reporters who you do want to hear directly from. Then we want to say, and we do this in our format, here's the news, here's my opinion, or here's my take.
Well, I mean, I was thinking about just in the context of the debt limit stories that have been, you know, that played out over the last month or so. And I remember I covered the debt limit for many, many years. And, you know, I would write what the protagonists were saying, but then I would try to find ways, I mean, in this context, to say, you know, President Biden said he won't negotiate, but in fact, all presidents, you know, ultimately do have to negotiate on a debt limit. And McCarthy says he won't back down, but, you know, he's being pressured by Wall Street and the financial markets to compromise. So those are the things that you put in your story, you know, fairly deep in. But what you do is you just label them as reporters, observations or something like that.
We try to sort of deconstruct this kind of black box of the news article and sort of tell you what's in it, and also to, you know, leave room for disagreement and bring in points of view that might disagree with ours or from other parts of the world.
Well, earlier you had mentioned about, I think it was in the context of the New York Times, saying that, you know, culture eats strategy for lunch. What sort of culture are you trying to develop at Semaphore? What is the kind of animating culture that you hope marks your news organization?
Yeah, I mean, our sort of watchwords are transparency and I guess kind of a global outlook. And so, you know, we've hired very globally and we do try to sort of be very transparent internally as externally when we have disagreements about stories, to try to air them in the stories where we can, actually, rather than try to resolve every disagreement internally.
In your book, you mentioned that you said every presidential campaign cycle is defined by a news outlet. We're still a year and a half away from this presidential election, but what presumably Semaphore wants to be part of that. But I mean, how do you apply it to what's unfolding now?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, something I think about a lot. We had my reporter covering Trump had a huge story that's been leading the Drudge Report all day. So I would say that I think we're sort of in a good place on this right now. But I do think that, you know, politicians are themselves obsessed with communications, obsessed with media, and so they're very interested in what's new, in how to, and maybe more irrationally interested in it. And so politics does often find ways to wrap itself around communications technologies. I'm sure they're all obsessing right now about how to use AI, although no doubt it'll end in tears.
Well, that's. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I'd like to go to a couple of questions that have been emailed in. And the first one says, you know, what are the practical ways that AI will shape the development of your new company? How are you thinking about AI in terms of building a new company?
I mean, I think it's an incredible tool for, I mean, actually, like we use it to copy edit quite a bit. It's good for that. And again, it's pretty low end. Like, I think if people use the tool Grammarly, which is sort of I don't know if you'd call it AI or not. That's a bit of a labeling question, but I don't think very useful tool to avoid having typos. I don't think anybody thinks Grammarly is going to have like robots on street corners gunning people down anytime soon. And so there are these tools. I think the other really quite amazing tool is sort of video editing and animation, which is prohibitively expensive for news organizations. News organizations just don't use animation because it costs thousands and thousands of dollars a minute. And if you watch a Disney movie, you know, there's like 10 pages that list the 10,000 animators who worked on it. like AI, you know, this brings with it all sorts of concerns about deepfakes, but certainly like democratizes these tools. And in fact, if you looked at Everything Everywhere All at Once, which great movie, which, you know, won the Academy Awards this year, they had like 7 animators. And that's because they were using these tools that just essentially bring the cost of production down in a way that I find pretty interesting and means that there are interesting things to be created. I also think sometimes there's too much of a premium on writing in journalism, but ultimately like the core job is getting to the bottom of things, understanding them, finding facts nobody else knows. And if you're not a great writer and some tool can help you be a better writer, that's fine with me. But I do think readers ultimately want to hear from humans, not from AI. And I think some of the sort of talk of how AI is going to swallow journalism hasn't really like checked in with how consumers and readers act. Because I don't think people are like, I would like all my news from a bot. And then there are also quite scary things. I mean, to me, the most immediately alarming one is the voice imitation, which can be great. Like you could read all my stories out loud, my own voice in Hindi, like handy, right? If that's what you want. But also means you could record me for 3 seconds and then, you know, essentially continue me speaking and, you know, call my wife and tell her I lost my credit card number and get it from her. And I think, you know, you're going to wind up needing code words with your family and stuff, which is pretty scary.
Then we have another question about how Instagram and TikTok work in the news space. Are these, do you view them as sort of vehicles to convey news or how do you view them?
I mean, short video is obviously the sort of dominant form of media right now. And I think largely entertainment, but media is always largely entertainment. And I think TikTok in particular is this incredible juggernaut. But it's not mostly news. And the economics of those platforms really don't support, original, news gathering. Vice News, in fact, had really a fabulous TikTok account that, you know, it happily went bankrupt while maintaining. Or not happily, but and so there's not a lot of original journalism happening on those platforms, but there's a lot of stuff that is sort of journalism adjacent, like the kind of like, I'm going to tell you a spooky story about what happened underneath this bridge kind of stuff, you know, food reviews. I don't know, we'll sort of see where it goes. But I think for a lot of journalism, text is actually a pretty good way to communicate information, probably not going away.
Well, Ben, let's talk for just a couple minutes in conclusion about this book, your book, Traffic, and just maybe the sense of how you came to write it. I know you had lived through a really intense, traumatic, interesting, exciting, exhilarating time. What was the, and I know like in one of the notes you said you wanted to render this important era factually and accurately, but I mean, talk about just the challenge of having gone through a really, really intense experience and sitting down to write about it. I mean, even mechanically, did you just kind of sketch out your chronology of events and then start interviewing some of the many people that you talked to get their take of it? Or just talk about both the impetus for the book and then how you went about putting it together.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, the thing is, it's funny because the first half of this book was all stuff where that I was not really involved in. I had been a blogger and I'd copied a lot of what Gawker was doing, sort of in a sort of formal way, but I hadn't known those people. I'd been, a few blocks away in Manhattan doing something different. And so much of where things emerge from are always scenes. And these are people who, know each other and in a tiny little world. And so for me, it was actually incredibly interesting to go back and sort of to this world where I'd been on sort of the outside of the glass looking in and kind of get to figure, report it out and talk to all the people who I'd been reading but not really known at the time. And then actually it felt quite different to report on the things that I was involved in, though one of the things that you realize, you read about how unreliable eyewitness testimony is. And I hired a great fact checker to help me with the book in the final stages, and all of my worst errors were things that I thought I personally remembered. Were things about like where my like first person, I was there at the time, memory was wrong, rather than stuff other people had told me wrong.
Was it, and then in terms of like interviewing others, were you, I mean, because I think actually, particularly with Jonah and maybe Nick, a number of the interviews were done even via text. In fact, you say that you'd like to maybe explore an app that would be used to help these kind of texts be more useful for book writing. But I mean, so what was the mix between just kind of quick back and forth and just kind of long sit down conversations with people about their recollection of things?
I had a lot of very long conversations with people. There would also been, you know, these people are all writers and bloggers and had written at great length. The one person who wouldn't talk to me was a guy who'd run Deadspin for a while and had a horrible time of it. And he now writes a blog about sobriety, not Disconnected. You know, had been writing this very beautiful newsletter for years that I kind of mined. People, there had been oral histories through the years written. So there's a lot out there. And then I talked, you know, as to dozens and dozens of people at great length. Jonah Peretti, my old boss, was very kind of open about just, you know, sharing emails and things with me and letting me use things that had been confidential at the time. Denton, who I didn't really know but had always sort of followed, did not participate in a normal way, but I think this was normal for him. He just happily responded to text messages for, you know, 2 years of all sorts of random questions about things that had happened 20 years earlier. And then at the end, I shared with him a Google Doc with a bunch of questions and fact checks, which he contributed to, but I never spoke to him.
Yeah. Well, let me just ask you finally, in terms of, you know, what brings you kind of joy and professional fulfillment? I mean, talk about the various satisfactions you get from political reporting, editing, running a news organization, being an entrepreneur. It seems like you've done all of these things. I mean, what gives you the most pure satisfaction?
You know, I love breaking news. I mean, honestly, like I'm really a news hound and, you know, you can do whatever, you can have whatever theory you want about how news is best delivered and how people will consume it, which I have a lot of theories, but if you don't have news in it, you're never really going to be able to test that theory. And so I'm, you know, I love reporting. So.
Final question. I mean, we have, you know, students on this call. What would you, I like to ask my guests, you know, what you would tell students about, you know, what you have learned in terms of structuring a career, making decisions, organizing time. What I know you have three children yourself, but you know, what have you learned in your career that you would think useful for someone to at least think about as they organize their careers?
You know, I don't know. Like, I sort of have a screw loose, and I think this is kind of an unpopular opinion now, but like, I would do this if nobody paid me. Like, I really enjoy it. I don't have anything resembling kind of boundaries between work and my like kind of life and all those things that millennials are super into. I mean, I, you know, love spending time with my kids and spend a lot of it, but half the time I'm talking about, you know, some story and trying to get them to help me with it.
Great. Well, Ben, finally, in terms of Semaphore, for those of us who are interested in your organization, tell them a little bit about how they can follow you. And I know I subscribe to two of your newsletters, the one you have and also your daily one that Steve Clemens does. But how can people who want to just really study your work become more familiar with your company?
Yeah, I mean, semaphore.com is a place to go. And we have newsletters on, I think, 8 different areas. A great kind of global morning read called Flagship, a Washington one that John, I'm sure, is into. I write about media, fabulous reporters covering finance and tech. And I think, you know, we are looking to sort of both break news and then also really bring in the best from everywhere around these kind of high-level conversations with a lot of insight on key topics.
Okay. Is there another book in you at some point, or is this?
No time soon.
Great. Well, Ben, thank you so much. It's been a great conversation, and I've enjoyed following your work. And I continue to, I look forward to continuing to follow Semaphore and follow the 2024 campaign through your reporting as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you for having me, and it's so nice to meet you.
Great.
Thank you for listening to SimonCast, the official podcast of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. SimonCast is produced in collaboration with WSIU Public Radio. You can find SimonCast wherever you listen to podcasts, including NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and more. Please subscribe to new episodes as soon as they're posted and tell your friends about our show. For more information, visit paulsimoninstitute.org. Thank you for listening, and thank you for keeping the legacy of Paul Simon alive and well.